I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very, very grateful to be here. We just finished, there's an event called Woodstock of the South where we have some of the people who are wisest in their sobriety, a lot of old timers that come in and share how they work through the steps. And we just finished it this last weekend. And so normally I would be, after something like that, I'm kind of tired and take a couple days off, but it's just been just the opposite. We had bad weather, so a lot of the speakers didn't get out till Monday, and we had a big meeting on Tuesday, and today I drove, or started my trip down here yesterday, and Mike and Kay, who introduced themselves as being from Fort Wayne, Indiana, were at Woodstock, and one of the speakers there was Sandy B., and his daughter Conway is here, and I ran into her, and, you know, a lot of bright-looking faces out there, but I can tell you that, and I came in when I was young also, this becomes like family, and it's impossible to go someplace without knowing people that you know really well and intimately and that you are friends with and that they care about you and you care about them. And that's something I really didn't have before I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Congratulations on 12 years. Looking in at where you were 12 years ago, and I don't mean you personally, but this time, the universe, a dozen eggs cost 90 cents. The average rent was $715 for an apartment. Average new house was $136,000. A gallon of gas was $1.46. That was the year the first Harry Potter film came out. It was the, I got sober the year the first Star Wars film came out. And a beautiful mind, one best picture, and the first new version of Lord of the Rings film came out that year as well, too. Number three, Dale Earnhardt died that year, too young, in the last lap of the Daytona 500. A new company named Wikipedia went online that year. Apple released a new product, something different than a computer, called iPod. The iPod that was first. I've got an iPad. It's the iPod that was the first one. Enron declared bankruptcy. A Libyan terrorist was found guilty of bombing in the Pan Am airliner in Lockerbie, Scotland. Timothy McVeigh was executed for his part in the Oklahoma City bombing, and on September 11th, something that changed our lives, 19 terrorists flew four American planes into targets here on American soil. But probably the most important thing that happened for the people in this room anyway is that two guys from Washington, D.C. just happened to decide they'd start a new group called the Tampa Young People's Group. And my experience is those little things that we do that we don't think are that important, they weren't the big headlines and all that, but just starting a group, starting a meeting, sponsoring somebody, making a phone call to somebody, they change lives in our fellowship. The great thing about Young People's Group, and when I came in, we didn't really have a Young People's meeting or group in Louisville, Kentucky, where I got sober, but as I travel, I love Young People's Group because there's so much enthusiasm. And enthusiasm comes from the Greek word. It's derived from entheos, means God in us. And I think what we're attracted to is that spirit of love, that spirit of peace, that spirit of safety, something that makes us feel like we are safe, that we see when you're smiling, when you're having a good time, when you're here, when you're keeping commitments, when you're doing all the things you were talking about here from the podium earlier. I had no idea about anything of that sort when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from a family that would not, in fact, I'm the first alcoholic of record in my family. You wouldn't think that there'd be any reason for me to be alcoholic. But I took my first drink when I was 14 years old, and I was alcoholic from that point on. I came from this family where my father was one of the most decorated pilots in World War II, and his grandfather, for whom I'm named, Richard, he was Richard Heron Anderson, was a three-star general at Gettysburg, and his grandfather was Richard Clough Anderson, who was the commander of the first boat across the Delaware on Christmas Day under George Washington in 1776. And that's my family. My little sister's a retired Burke colonel. Her husband's a retired Burke colonel. Their boy graduated from West Point, blah, blah, blah. And so, and I just didn't fit in. I did not fit in at all with this family. And I had two tours in Vietnam. I got drunk and joined. Everybody else in the family was an officer, like I just said. I got drunk and joined the Marine Corps. The way I selected the branch of service that I went to was I went out with the different recruiters, and whoever drank best was the one that I went with. And the Marine captain that took me out drank just like I did. And I said, these guys are good. So I joined, but I didn't feel like I fit in at all. And the best way to describe me, I was kind of like Forrest Gump in Lieutenant Dan's family, but without the focus or the integrity. And so so from the very beginning, everything I did was kind of faking it. I faked it all the way around. I did the things I was supposed to. I acted like a clean-cut, smart young kid, all that. But I just didn't feel like I fit in. The activities I was involved in all taught me the same kind of morals that we learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was involved in Little League, YMCA, Boy Scouts, 4-H, all of those things. Boy Scout handbook says the way we please God best is by doing something for another person each day anonymously. That's what we do in this fellowship. But I couldn't get it. I could not get it. And I went along with it. I did what I was supposed to. The one area where I felt safe, when I was a kid, I read a lot. And we had, when I was in grade school, they came out with this invention that was a little tube, black and white, called television. And that came out while I was in grade school. And so I started watching TV, and the TV shows that I watched also had the same morals that these other things had. The Andy Griffith Show, Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best. And so those became the place where I felt, and I can't explain this, and it's still to this day, this is what I do. What I do for a living is write and produce film. And back then, the best way to reach me was not to talk to me in person, but to have something on television that I would watch. And I felt like I actually was part of that show. And that's still true to this day. So I watched all these shows, and if Opie or Wally got kind of in some kind of a mess, I would watch the show, and by the end of the show, Dad had taken his pipe and turned it to one side, and whatever he said was without judgment. I was scared of judgment. And he would say something gentle, and Opie or Wally would get the message, and they would get back on the beam. And so that became my moral compass. That's where I went. If I had a problem, I watched what Opie did and what Wally did, and I fit in. I couldn't tell anybody in person what was going on with me, and I was kind of like, newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have something that is really a great thing if you get one, and it's called a sponsor. But I was without a sponsor. They didn't have a sponsor in Boy Scouts. They didn't have a sponsor in Little League. I went to church and Vacation Bible School. They didn't have a sponsor there. So I didn't have anybody telling me that there were certain things I was supposed to do. So I had my first spiritual experience when I was about 7, 8 years old. And we went to the drive-in with my mom, my dad, my little sister, the soon-to-be-retired Burke colonel. She was the son that my dad wanted. She did everything that I was supposed to do. And so, not that I resent her. And so, but we went and we were watching. And here, well, this is back in the, movies were black and white, and television was black and white. But this was the first color film I had ever seen. The Big Book says the lack of power is our dilemma, and that's exactly what I felt like. I didn't fit in. I didn't have the power. My dad and all my uncles, they go off. They're in their uniforms. They go fly a plane. They come back wherever the mission was, and they had this power. I could tell they did, and they weren't. And my dad died earlier this year. He was widely respected, but they didn't sit around and brag. They didn't go to the VFW and tell war stories or anything like that and tell people what they were like. They were just very humble. I heard war stories about my dad when I went to some bombing reunions where he had saved people's lives, pulled people out of a burning plane. He never mentioned any of that to me. It wasn't the kind of thing that my family did. I would have, but it wasn't the kind of thing that the rest of the family did. So so we go to this movie, and the first thing is this movie was 120 feet wide. TVs were real small back then. 120 foot wide on the screen, and it was in color. I had never seen anything in color before, and this was not only color, it was in Technicolor. And I had never seen the kind of power that I saw in this film. There was a guy up there, and he had this big stick, and he would just turn it to one side, and the wind would blow through his hair, and the Red Sea would part. The name of the movie was The Ten Commandments. And I made two decisions that night. One, that I wanted to be around that, whatever that was, and God heard me. I mean, I've been around the film business for a long time. The second was that I wanted to be on God's side, because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so the next day, much to the surprise of my parents, who did not know I was having a spiritual awakening in the back of the 55 Ford, I went down the aisle at Linden Baptist Church, and they were playing We Surrender All, and I was probably about this tall, and I surrendered all. And I went down, and I had a very emotional experience. I think I felt like I had met God. I had had this experience, and I was crying, and I went down the aisle, and my mom and dad were going, "What's..." You know, because they went to the same movie, but they didn't have the same experience I did. And I gave everything. But I was like the newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and comes to meetings and sits here and fellowships, but doesn't do any of the steps, doesn't do any of the work. And I didn't have a sponsor. They didn't have sponsors at Linden Baptist Church for kids. And so I didn't have anybody telling me that I needed to take some steps to change. So after a few days, weeks, whatever it was, I was still the same scared little Baptist Boy Scout I'd been when I walked down that aisle. And so I thought that meant that I was not one of the chosen ones. They had this phrase back then, the chosen ones. You are one of the chosen ones. And I could see you were smiling, you were happy, you had a happy family, you seemed genuine, and I didn't get any of that. And I walked down the aisle. I got dipped and dunked and went through the whole thing, and I didn't get it. So I felt like God didn't want me. If somebody's chosen, somebody's not chosen. You know, and for guys anyway, you know that you go out on the baseball field and you're playing, you know, sandlot ball, and somebody gets picked and somebody doesn't get picked, and the worst thing that can happen to you is you don't get picked. And that's the way I felt. I felt God didn't want me. And so now I'm not fitting in with my family. Hadn't for a long time. I was faking it, trying to pretend to be somebody I wasn't. I knew that they were different than me. I knew I was different than them. And so that's the way it just kind of slid into every relationship I had of the human variety. I didn't really fit in. Now I try to go and have this relationship with God, and He doesn't want me. So if you're 8 years old and you don't have good relationships with people or God, there's no place to go. And I just started living in my head. Those TV shows, movies, whatever I was watching, anything. I can remember vividly every scene from almost every film that I saw for a long time. The next film that I saw was Hansel and Gretel. It was in color and it was clay animation. And so that stuff I knew. But real life, was still continuing to have difficulty. Now, I did what I was supposed to, so it would look like I was this all-American young kid, and I was doing the right things. I made good grades. I was good in sports. I was good in music. But I just did it until I could get to wherever I was going to go, and where I was going to go happened when I was 14 years old, and we were playing Babe Ruth League baseball, and I was camping out, and I was the center fielder, and the left fielder got his older brother to give us a six-pack of beer and a half pint of gin. And he drank the gin, and I drank the beer. And I don't remember at which point during that six-pack it happened. I just remember at some point, all of a sudden, I felt like I thought Moses must have felt. I was about 10 feet tall. The wind was blowing through my hair. I had hair back then. Just so you know, and so you don't get real cocky, the goal of being an AA is to stay sober for a day at a time, but for a long period of time. And if you are successful at that, when you get older, you will not have hair, and it will be silver. So I'm going to this. So I'm drinking the beer, and I absolutely lost any sense of fear or being out of place. I felt like I fit in, and from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk, and going to town when you're 14 means hitchhiking. And we hitchhiked up to a place called the White Castle, and I don't think they have White Castles here. They have White Castles here. No, okay. Well, anyway, White Castle is a place you go at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're drunk to get these hamburgers that are real small but have 8,000 onions on each one of them, which seemed like a good idea when you're drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning, but not so much the next day. And so we go hitchhiking up to the White Castle, and before then I would not have been at ease with anybody there because they were all adults. And adults were very different than kids back then. Adults all had a pipe and wore a tie and hats and stuff. So we're up there, but I am absolutely feeling at ease. I discovered table hopping that night. I'm bouncing around, and I'm 14. I'm talking with all the 40-year-olds and finding out what's going on with them. I get a crush on this girl that was working behind the counter, a good-looking redhead. She's married, but you know. So I can let a few rules slip by. So I'm getting things going with her and having a great time. And my buddy Dave is not having the same spiritual experience I'm having. Dave is starting to feel a little woozy. And so I had never had a cup of coffee before, but I had seen in Perry Mason where if you have too much to drink, you get a cup of coffee and it sobers you up so you can talk to the police. So I ordered a cup of coffee for my buddy Dave, but it did not have the desired effect. Dave threw up down the stainless steel counter, which, of course, messed up my whole thing going on with the 30-year-old woman behind the counter. And so, as it turns out, if you're looking for a Louisville City policeman at midnight, the best place to find him is at the White Castle. So two of them came down and said, "What's the matter with your friend?" And I said, "Well, he's just had a little bit too much to drink." "Really? How old is he?" "14. How old are you?" "14. So I was in Louisville City jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could, from that point on. The feeling that I had, and of course I got into trouble for getting locked up and being taken downtown. My dad came and picked me up. He wasn't happy about it at all. But the feeling that I had, all I could hear is there's a cartoon where you hear the dogs, and the dogs are going are listening, and the human beings going, "Yep, yep, yep," and you can't understand what they're saying. I don't remember anything that the humans were saying. All I remember was alcohol. All I could think about was alcohol was beckoning to me. I wanted to have my next drink. Now, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't had anything to eat for the last 2 years. I was a street drunk. I had brain damage. It took me over a year to learn how to read again. I had a lot of internal damage, and I was 27 years old. I could very well have come to Alcoholics Anonymous and had no question as to whether or not I was alcoholic when I was 17, but it just didn't happen that way for me. And so I would have told you when I got here that my drinking problem started that last 2 years, but here's what happened the first 3 times I take a drink. The first time I take a drink, I get into a lot of trouble, but I cannot wait until the next drink. And I drank beer the first time. Didn't taste good. Second time I drank something I would highly recommend if you're going to have a slip. It was something one of the older, I transferred to a new high school, and I was playing, I was the starting quarterback on the JV football team, and this kid he dressed varsity and played JV like me, and he got me a bottle of cherry vodka. And the third time that I drank what I drank until I got to AA, which was Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Now, none of the times that I drank those in the beginning did they taste good at all, but they got me there that much quicker. I never cared about any social aspect or what it tasted like. I only cared about what it did for me and the way it transported me to this feeling that I had no fear, that I was grown up, that I could do anything I wanted to. That's the only time and place I ever felt comfortable in my entire life. Now, I continued reading a lot. I continued seeing a lot of movies, but I also continued. When I did drink, because I felt no fear, I wouldn't hesitate at all to correct you if you were an authority figure. And so by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested 22 times, and only one of them was DUI, and none of them were for crimes of intelligence or commerce where you made money or things like that. They were all for crimes of defiance, which is, by the way, the one defining characteristic of the new alcoholic is defiance. Nobody's going to tell me what to do, and you're in a program where the solution is, please tell me what to do. So I ended up getting arrested 6 times my senior year. And I got arrested. Now, I had made good enough grades on my SATs in the ninth grade that I could get into Brown, Harvard, any place I wanted to. But by the time I got out of school, I had to have my uncle, who was a dean at the University of Kentucky, vouch for me to get in because of my arrest record, just so I could get into a state school. And I had kind of lost any drive to do anything at that point anyway. And so, but my senior year, I get locked up. I was continuing to watch movies. Right after my senior year, there was a movie that came out called The Graduate, and I saw it. If I see a movie and I really like it, I see it like 10 times. So I saw The Graduate 10 times, and I had made it all the way through school without smoking, and I saw The Graduate and started smoking, had an affair with an older woman. And she'd be about 89 now. But my senior year, I got locked up 6 times, and I got locked up at my senior prom. And we have something the same weekend as senior prom in Louisville. It's a horse race called the Kentucky Derby. And so I thought I knew all about race relations because there were 2 black kids in my class. I played quarterback. One of them was a halfback and his sister. And I got along with both of them, so I thought, you know, I had the whole race relations thing pretty well taken care of. That night that I got locked up, because we did have out-of-town guests in for the Derby, I got locked up, and this time I'm over 18, so it's not a juvie account. I'm put in the real felon tank because it was 2 counts of assault and battery on a police officer at my senior prom, and so they put me in there with the other felons, and there are 8 bays and or 8 beds, bunks, and they put me in with 7 people that were very angry and had brought a bunch of explosives in to blow up Churchill Downs. And because of the way I lived, my dad had said, if you're going to live that way, you can't, if you're going to act that way, you can't live here. So I had moved out of my parents' house when I was a sophomore in high school. I worked hard enough to pay for the rent so that I could share an apartment with some older kids, and they never knew where I was. And so I now know that one of the things that I regret the most, the thing that hurts my heart the most, is the way I treated my parents, because they were very good parents. But I just put that all aside. I didn't even think about it back then. I would go home occasionally to emotionally blackmail my mother so I could get something from her, or to try to talk my dad into co-signing on something. But, you know, that's all I was there for. I did not. I was not a good son. And so they had no idea where I was. My little sister, who's the one that, you know, did all the things I was supposed to do, was a year and a half younger than me, but she was just one class behind me. So she went to our prom, so she kind of knew something had happened, but wasn't quite sure. But I had been arrested at my senior prom for these 2 counts of assault and battery on a police officer, and they're still trying to figure out where I am when I show up on network television the next day on ABC, NBC, and CBS, because my seven cellmates who were there to blow up Churchill Downs were 7 Black Panthers who had come into, this was in the 60s, they had come into Louisville to blow up Churchill Downs to make a statement for, and so the next morning on CBS, NBC, and ABC News, everybody found out where I was, because there I was in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket with my 7 Black Panther friends. And the other kids didn't get to do this kind of stuff. I mean, I remember I went to this school where it was kind of a preppy school, and everybody was going to Harvard, Brown, Yale, Princeton, whatever. You know, we had a few that were going to West Point or to, you know, the Naval Academy. You know, I used my uncle to get into University of Kentucky. And so, you know, I was chairman, as I remember, of the breakfast committee. I'm a very social person. And so, they didn't know where I was because I was in jail, and somebody came down, got me out, and so forth. But that's just the way it was. And so I go off to University of Kentucky, you know, my parents, at this point, you know, I hardly see them, but I worked hard, and I made enough money to actually pay for, tuition was only $80 a semester back then, so it wasn't like a large amount, but I was paying, it was almost free to go to a state school, and I had a job on the newspaper. I was a very good writer and a very good musician from early days, and so I had a job with the newspaper where I got paid $80 a month to be the circulation manager, where I just delivered the paper around the campus, and it only cost me $80 for tuition, and I think my share of the rent was $30, so I paid for my school. I was down there. I could very well have finished school, but one night we were sitting and we were talking, and our parents had all been World War II veterans, and we were proud of them, and so we were talking about it. We didn't want to miss out on what they had and this camaraderie that they had, and we had this conversation about it. The next morning we get up. Now, they all sobered up the next morning, so when they got up, it didn't occur to them to actually go down and meet with the recruiters. But I got up the next morning and went down, and I had my interviewed the recruiters and found the one that I liked. And he was a Marine, so I'm off, and I take off, and I go to... Now, in high school, I had been the lower companion. I was the guy whose sister's boyfriend, who also played on the football team, was not allowed to be in a car or any place where I was. No, most people were not allowed to be there. They didn't allow their kids to be around me when we were in high school. But now I found a group of people who were, to me, a lower companion. We didn't have anything except whiskey or wine or beer. We didn't see any drugs or anything when I was in high school. It just wasn't around. We drank something called Rebel Yell, which was a bottle of whiskey that had a Confederate flag on it. And so I ended up... I'll explain later, but I had an operation. I had cancer 8 years ago, and so they removed my esophagus, and now and then my mouth gets a little bit dry. But I take off. I go to Vietnam, and there was a group of people I could look down on because there were a number of people that were doing drugs in Vietnam. They were smoking joints, doing hash, whatever you want to call it. And so... So now I've got a group of people I can look down on. I felt like if you did drugs, you lacked self-discipline. And so, but I did well. I did fine. When you're in the service, you put down where you want to go, and I put Key West, Key West, Key West, because they had a detachment down there. I got Vietnam, and the Pentagon, and... So I go off to Vietnam. I actually did well in combat. I think that's mostly due to our family gene pool or something. And I made good rank. I wasn't an officer, but I was a staff sergeant within a very short time and so forth. I came back to serve time at the Pentagon, and that did not work as well. They have these meetings in the morning at like 5:30. In combat, you go off, you've got a mission, you do whatever you're going to do. If you come back, you know, you get organized, and you have a little bit of time to rest up before you go back out. But at the Pentagon, the generals and the colonels are having these meetings at 5:30 in the morning or 6 or whatever, which is hard to balance when you're dating a girl that works at the massage parlor and taking her home at 4 o'clock in the morning and look good when you get there at 5:30. So it just didn't work. So my career in the military I knew wasn't going to last. I got out. I go back to Louisville, Kentucky. I had met a woman that was absolutely stunning. I was engaged 6 times before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody would ever marry me, but I was engaged 6 times. And all of them looked like somebody that I met in the movies. When Romeo and Juliet came out, Franco Zeffirelli version with Olivia Hussey, I got engaged to a nurse that looked like Olivia Hussey. Well, this one, she looked like Olivia Newton-John. And I know a lot of young people in here, but you can Google these people. Just trust me, Olivia Newton-John was, or Bing, you know, whatever. And I'm hip. So... So Olivia Newton-John was striking, and one of the guys that I drank with, who was a gunny sergeant named Frank, was married to a girl named Bun, or Bunny, depending upon whether you used one or two syllables. But anyway, they came back, and upstairs living in this duplex was their friend Kathy, and Kathy was the one that looked like Olivia Newton-John. And I was absolutely in love with her. We just had a great time. I started working. Now I get out of the service. I'm working for an ad agency. Worked for a magazine for a while. I worked for an ad agency. I know I'm going to go off and be producing feature films any moment now, but I start by doing commercials. And so we are having this really hot relationship. We're off. We're spending all our time together. We're talking about marriage. We're talking about where we want to go on the honeymoon. We're just trying to figure out what to do with her husband. And he was an attorney and an advance man for Nixon, who was running for re-election. And so, but you know how we are. Alcoholics do have willpower. People talk about us not having willpower. And I stuck in there and We had some run-ins. You know, I was an expert marksman on active duty. He was an attorney. I went after him a few times with a shotgun. He was an attorney. He came after me a few times with a warrant. But I stuck in there until I got her out of this bad relationship. And so we were about 3 weeks away from getting married. And I was not I was a round-the-clock drinker. I drank Country Club malt liquor before I went to homeroom. I drank during any of the breaks. My house was about 50 yards away from the schoolyard. Plus, I took my car over there, so I had all kinds of hiding places where I kept my booze. And so I drank around the clock in high school. I couldn't do that all the time in combat, but other than that, I drank all the time. So because I didn't have a lot of blackouts. I had gray periods. Everything was a little vague. I might get confused about some of the details, like what state I was in, but I didn't wake up wondering where I was, except for now and then when I would go on a binge on top of the round-the-clock drinking. And I can't explain that any way than if you don't do it, you don't do it. But some people drink like I did around the clock, but now and then we'd go on binges on top of it. So about 3 weeks before Kathy and I were supposed to get married, I went on this binge and missed a couple of days. And she said to me, I haven't told you this, but my dad is died of alcoholism, and you can't just, it's not normal to just lose a couple of days and not know where you were. And I said, well, I don't think I was doing anything inappropriate. She said, that's not the point. You don't know where you were. And so we ended up, and any time that anybody gave me any hint of rejection, I just walked away. There was no discussing anything. And she said, I think we should postpone the wedding until we deal with this. And instead of something as a reasonable sort, like, yes, maybe we should have talked about it and so forth, I thought that she was rejecting me, and I walked away immediately, and I just thought that's the end. And now I'm hurt because when anybody rejected me, I was hurt, and the only thing I can think of was what to do to comfort me. I couldn't comfort myself anymore with alcohol because I couldn't drink anymore. I didn't do well with drugs, as I mentioned. I looked to people that did drugs as lacking discipline. And I'm not saying I didn't smoke a few joints or accidentally do LSD on a plane ride one time, but but again, Wild Turkey 101 was my primary thing. And so the only way to comfort me was there was a concept that I had found. When you're in Vietnam, they would bring these magazines we hadn't seen before, a certain kind of beer, hams or things from the West Coast, and we'd buy a beer for a nickel. There were things that we did that they were trying to promote it to get us to try different things. And there was a magazine over there that I had not seen before called Penthouse. And and especially for young people who can go online and find, two pygmies and somebody's sister, we didn't have that. The closest thing that I had to pornography back then was the tribal section of National Geographic. And so I had seen Playboy, but I hadn't seen Penthouse. And so over there, we're reading Penthouse, and there was a section in there, and as you can tell, my friends and I were very intelligent people. And so so there was a section in there called Forum, or Letters, where they would describe different approaches to lifestyle and so forth and we would discuss these ideas and different philosophies and so forth. And there was one in there called a Menage a Trois. And so obviously we didn't speak French at the time either, but the idea of this menage just seemed like a good idea, and I had remembered it. I had brought it back here, and in fact had brought it up several times with my fiancé, usually at intimate moments. But her having formerly been married to a Nixon aide, she was a little conservative, so she wasn't going for that. So now she's tossed me out, my heart is broken, and I'm trying to figure a way to comfort myself, and I look, so I decide that I want to have a menage. And this is in Louisville, Kentucky, 45 years ago, and I know Louisville's the kind of cutting edge of hip, but there, I bring this up because this is the kind of trouble you can get into without a sponsor. in order for me to find this menage, there was another concept in there, which I now know I completely misunderstood, but I thought if I'm going to have a menage, I would like for it to be with two women who like each other. And the word for that, according to these letters, was lesbian. And so I went looking for a lesbian bar in Louisville, Kentucky, 45 years ago, where I could find two women who wanted to have a menage with me. And if you're not sure what's wrong with that, keep coming back. So I live in this apartment complex. There are 11 of us. We all know each other. We have our own private pool. Whoever gets up first on Sunday morning pops the keg. We play volleyball out in the pool. Some of them were married, but if not, you brought. If you had a stay over, you would bring her out to and introduce her to all your alcoholic friends. Great life. And so, but these guys are square, you know, it's Marines, Army, Navy, you know, we got all the flags out there, stuff like that. We could have had a John Birch meeting if we wanted to. And so I'm not going to find out from them where to go to find a lesbian bar. So, but I'm working at this advertising agency, writing and producing commercials. I ended up, spreading the word quietly. This is not something you want to just spring on people. And, that I'm looking for a lesbian bar, and one of the men, one of the art directors in the back, came and said, I understand you're looking for a lesbian bar. I said, yeah. And so he told me where it was, gave me the address, and I went back and I said, I wonder how he would know. But anyway, there was a great deal that we didn't get a handbook on how all this stuff was going to unfold. But anyway, so I go back, I find this place, I go down there on a Saturday night, and there are only two people there besides me. There's a guy playing the piano, and there's this woman at the bar. And she's another veteran, and she's, we're getting along fine, but I can tell there's not going to be any menage. And so, he's singing songs and stuff. And I'm, as I said, you know, I started smoking after seeing The Graduate, so I'm smoking my L&Ms and drinking my straight Wild Turkey, no water, bruises the flavor, and nothing's happened. I think I've got some bad information, and I had just gotten to that point in the evening where you could just get enough of that whiskey and enough of the smoke where you have that kind of come hither voice, and you are not going to get any sexier than you are, and if it's going to happen, it needs to happen now, but there is nothing. I'm very disappointed, and all of a sudden, this door opens up at the other end of the room, and it's a room about, you know, half the size of this, but about as far as that wall over there. And from the top, there's this cascading staircase, and there's this spectacularly looking, beautiful woman with red hair and a long gown that comes just flowing down almost in slow motion. And she was coming to the middle of the dance floor, and I found myself just being transported to the middle of the dance floor, and we're holding each other, and we're kissing each other, and we cannot get enough of each other. And you know how when you're in love, you take three steps over here and you start kissing again because you just don't want it to go away. And then I remembered my mission. I said, by the way, do you have a friend who could join us tonight? And she said, her name was Erica. She said, oh, you're into that. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, why don't we get to know each other tonight, and we'll add somebody tomorrow night. I said, thank God I did not marry that Republican woman. And so we keep going, and we're going out to the car, and this is Louisville, Kentucky, and the main street down there where there weren't lots of malls and stuff back then. It's just this one place. So I'm thinking, this is one beautiful girl. She's going to look great tomorrow morning when we're up playing volleyball. And I mentioned to her that I had a pool, and I said, did she want to stop and pick up her bathing suit? She said, who needs a bathing suit? And so I said, she is going to be popular at the place. So we get in the car, we go back home, and drugs rears its ugly head again one more time. She pulls out a pill that was big enough to choke a horse. It was actually a horse tranquilizer called a Quaalude, and said, would you care for one? I said, no thanks, I don't do drugs. And I took another hit or two off my Wild Turkey, and two things happened. Erica passed out, and I found some equipment I definitely wasn't looking for. And after 3 or 4 days, I said, this is not right. This is the point at which I was uncertain about what to do, because I had never seen Opie or Wally deal with this in any episode. So, as you can tell, things weren't going all that well. I got fired from my job that same week. I got fired because, according to my, are you giving me that because you've got 15 minutes left? How much time did I have to start? Because I was doing an hour. Okay. Well, I'll try. So, I ended up getting fired from that job for missing 83 days. So that's what was going on in my life. I do get fired from that job, but I always had a girlfriend lined up, or I always had something else. And I was lined up. I had a job with the world's largest ad agency in New York. And I go to New York. I had a couple of Clios. I won. I did a commercial. They tried out. You've got a football team here. Had a football player and a little kid for Coca-Cola, where they trade a jersey for a Coke, and so forth. And so I actually did very good work when I was there, but I didn't work that much. And so while I was up there, I was producing some music back before they had computers, the music was, I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, and I had a lot of musicians and so forth. And I went in at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't talk. And I went around to a corner bar, and I couldn't even find a bar that was open. I went, found this little tiny bar. I walk in there, and they pour me a triple. And I remember thinking, I wonder how they know I'm a big drinker. Now, I just left all the musicians and everybody back at the studio, I was the youngest creative director they had at this place, and I was paid very well, but I just walked out because I couldn't talk at that time of the morning. I spilled that all over the bar, and they poured me another one. And I'd seen a movie called Lost Weekend with Ray Milland, where he uses a towel as a lever, and I got it up. Anyway, I got moved from that job, fired from that job. I was in Atlanta, and I was before long, I was out on the street. And I had been, my last year or two, all I did was live on a bathroom floor in a basement apartment before I got evicted. And I didn't talk to anybody. I wasn't in touch with my family, with my friends, or anybody else. And that was my entire life. And finally, after being evicted, I went up to the liquor store, and I walked in, and somebody said, the manager wants to talk to you, and he said, we know this check's no good, and all of the last few checks you've written are no good, and we need to ask you not to come in here anymore. And as humiliating as that was, the one thing that I thought was, oh, God, I hope he gives me that whiskey, because all I ever cared about was having that whiskey from the time I took the first drink. And he gave me that bottle of whiskey, and I walked out, and like in slow motion again, that bottle of whiskey fell and hit the concrete, I had no place to go. I was more scared than I ever was in a firefight in Vietnam because I couldn't live without that whiskey, and I couldn't get any whiskey, and I didn't know where to go. And so I had one pair of pants and one shirt and some loafers that had a hole in the bottom of them, but I carried a .45. I got very paranoid my last few years, and I carried that with me out on the street, and I got ready to put a bullet in my head, I got angry at God because of what he had done to me, because he turned away from me, because he didn't want me, and because I didn't have what I wanted out of life, and because I thought that he should have done something for me. And I started screaming at God because I was getting ready to put a bullet in my head. I said, God, blanket, God, blanket, God, blanket. And I stopped and said, God, help me, God, help me, God, help me. And a moment of peace came over me, and just like the TV shows I'd seen before, a movie called Days of Wine and Roses, where Jack Klugman walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I surrendered, and I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner, and I called this woman named Helen. And Helen answered the phone, and Helen sent out a guy named Ed. And Helen was with us last weekend. She runs our central office in Atlanta, and Helen now has 45 years, and I'm coming up on 37. Because Helen knows how to stay sober. She helps other alcoholics. And from that day until now, I've not been without a group of people, men especially, who would work with me day in, day out to make sure that I stayed sober. I had brain damage, and it took me a year to learn how to read, so I couldn't understand what you were talking about. And we didn't have in those days all these where they go around and explain what the big book means. Dr. Bob says it needs no explanation. You just need to work the steps. We didn't have all the other stuff. You can be an intellectual giant in AA and get drunk all day long. So I went with the people when they would 12-step these drunks, and that helped me stay sober. And I lived in a basement apartment that somebody gave me where I would stay up with the drunks at night. And I poured coffee at one of those clubs. And that's how I stayed sober the first year. I didn't have a job or anything except that. I made enough to pay for my cigarettes and to live, and that was it. And that's exactly what I needed. But I had a membership in my home group, and I had a job in my home group, and I went to 10 meetings a week, and 9 of them were speaker meetings, which I think is the best way to convey the power and the progress of this program. And the other was a big book, 12 and 12. We just read and talked about the steps, and you shared your experience. If you'd worked a step, if not, you could ask a question. And so I'm going to zip through a couple of things to get to the spiritual awakening. I finally get through on my fourth or fifth, because I had brain damage, I didn't remember much at first, but my fourth or fifth inventory, I realized I was angry at everybody. You can't be separated from people and be in love with them at the same time. And so I was angry at everybody, and I started going to forgive people and trying to make and to do something so I would fit my way back into their lives. And that worked, but I started making amends. I go to this Linda Baptist Church where I had thought God had thrown me out in the first place, and I got up on a Sunday night and apologized. And a couple things happened. One, there were people in there in that church that after that night treated me just like people in AA. They loved me. They loved me unconditionally. And I found out that God doesn't exist just in AA meetings. Secondly, there was a girl in there that night, and she was a beautiful young blonde, and she was two things I wasn't looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl. I was kind of looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual guidance. And but because I didn't meet her on a 13th step, I met her doing a 9th step. She and I have been married 30 years, and she's at home praying for me right now. And she's as active in Al-Anon as I am in AA. She's past delegate. She does lots and lots of work, sponsors a lot of women, and she was there with Megan. She worked at the place where Megan started to get sober. And so things started happening to me. Ninth steps was going to the church where we actually had the funeral for my dad earlier this year. And I slowly made amends to all these people. I made amends to my dad, and my dad was best man when my wife and I got married. That's just a result of me calling him and working. It happened for about 3 or 4 years. I had to work on just being a friend to him. And so I go back to this ninth step, and I go in there, and there's nobody there. And I realize who I'm there for is God. I'd been asking God to keep me sober in the morning and thanking him at night, but I didn't trust God. I was angry at God. I didn't really feel like God fit in. I didn't feel connected to God. And so I got down on my knees, and I started forgiving God. I had forgiven people who didn't really do anything to harm me, but I knew I was angry at them. So I started forgiving God. And one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had took place. I felt like there was a wind that was just blowing through me, and I felt like all of that fear and all of that hurt just dropped off my shoulders. And I realized for the first time in my life I was connected to this God, that I was a child of this spiritual father. And it doesn't make any difference what way you or I talk about him. I just know that I had this relationship. Now I am one of God's family. I'm a child of God. And then right after that, I'll finish with two stories. Right after that, I go to Gethsemane, where we went every year to do a house cleaning. And I still do that because it's kind of hard to keep growing if you're doing one house cleaning. And so we go, and we're at Gethsemane, and there's this priest there, and he's talking, and he says, "You boys are now I've had this spiritual experience where I know there's a God, and God loves me, and I know that I can get along with people." And he says, this priest says, "You boys are always talking about what God's will is. Do you know what it is?" And none of us ventured to guess. And he said, "God's will is this simple. It's to do the best that you can right now with what he gives you to be useful to other people. If you're a husband, be a good husband. If you're a father, be a good father. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If God got you sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, be the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous you can. Sponsor people, show up, make the coffee, do the best you can until God gives you something else to do." He said, "If you have a job, do it honorably and love people with that job until God gives you another job. If you have a job you hate, do it honorably and love people through that job until he gives you another job." And that's a great way to live your life. And I've done that since that day. But I can tell you that there are some days that you don't want to have if you stay sober long enough. And in 2005, my wife and I were not able to have any children, but we had a dog named Booger Bear, who a Norwegian Elkhound we'd taken to about 300 conferences, and And he went every place with us, and he was like a child, and we had to put him to sleep. And Barbara and I were crying. I thought we would never cry more than we did then. Within 6 weeks, my mother and my wife's mother and father all died unexpectedly. So we lost 3 out of 4 parents. And that was 2005. We go to Toronto, to the International. I've been to 7 of them. I put in the bid for the one we're having in Atlanta, so I hope to see you there in 2015. And we go to Toronto, and we come back from Toronto, and I go in to take a physical, and I'm told that I have esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer is 99% fatal. And there are only a few places where they have found anything to do about it, and it's a very severe operation, severe recovery. They remove all your esophagus, every lymph node in my chest, all of those things. And I found a doctor who could do this. Now, I didn't tell Barbara that I had this because she just lost both her parents. We put our dog to sleep. So until I find a solution, I'm not going to tell her. And because I can't tell her, I can't tell you because you don't gossip. And so I finally find the solution. And it's out at the University of Southern California. And I was speaking that weekend down at Key West on a Saturday night. And I get the phone call on Friday on the way down there. And they said, by the way, we can do the operation, but we can't accept your insurance. But if you have $500,000 that you can put into an equity account here, we can do it that way. And I'm not a good money manager, and I didn't have the money. And I'm angry at God. And if you've been in the sunlight of the Spirit and suddenly you're in the darkness, it's worse than it ever was before. You didn't know the sunlight. And so now I don't know what to do. And I'm going to die because my God doesn't have the ability to get me the right kind of insurance. And so I can't even pray. I start praying and I wander around the place. And a friend of mine said, look, when I've been like that, I just say whatever prayer I can remember. And I had memorized the 23rd Psalm for the PTA in the third grade. And so I started saying it over again, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And I said it. And finally, I just let go. And I went to speak that night, and I was okay because I remembered before I went up there, my sponsor in Louisville, Kentucky, who had lung cancer that spread to his brains, and when he was telling me that he was going to go, he wasn't afraid. And I said, Jack, you're not afraid. He said, if God is this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting on the other side. And so if God's going to take me home, I'm okay. If I'm going to paradise, there are a lot worse things. And so I come back here, and on Monday I got a phone call. And my way, the way I write movies, there'd be sunlight coming through, and they'd say, God called us and said that we should take care of you without the insurance. But that's not the way it worked. He called and said, we still can't help you, but our chief of surgery, who is the guy that perfected this, just went up to Rochester, New York. Why don't you call him? We've sent him your information. So I talked to him 2 hours later, and he says, come on up. Now I tell Barbara, because she needed to know, and we drive up there. Yeah. Well, I had told her I had some diseased tissue that was going to be removed, which is true. And so so now we're on the way up there. We get there, and we didn't think we knew anybody in Rochester, New York, way up there. And we walk in, and that night at the hotel, there were 23 people there, A's and Al-Anons, because we'd been active in service and active in AA. They were there. We had a new home group. We had a new home group in AA and Al-Anon, and they stayed with us the whole time. They took Barbara out to eat. They did her laundry. They did everything. You've got a new family when you come here. And so we went to the hospital the next day to meet with the doctor, and we walk into the chapel because that's where, if it's going to work, the source and the power is going to come from there. And up on the wall, in letters that were 1.5 feet deep in gold, 30 feet high, it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And we walk out into the lobby to see where God's brought us. And it's Strong Memorial Hospital, endowed by the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, without whom I would never have had any life here at all. My experience is this. Not drinking is one of the things we do to have the spiritual awakening. But as a result of that spiritual awakening, if I'm willing just to do what it asks me in those simple steps and learn a few other principles in this program, I have power that I never even imagined. Whether it's cancer, whether it's Katrina, whether it's finding the right job, whether it's finding the right spouse, there has never been anything in my life that I was looking for that I didn't find through the principles of this program. And if God gives me that in this program, why would I ever want to numb myself from the good life that he's given me? If you're new, this is not going to happen all at once. You grow into this. But if you're new, my experience is better. Day one here is better than the best day out there. My wish is that everybody in this room would stay here. But generally, that's not the way it works. We get sober by working the program, the steps, not by working the fellowship. So if you can find somebody who's serious about working the steps, who has a higher power, you just found a secret to life. Thank you.
Let's thank Dick one more time for his service. And I've asked Terry.